And we've got two guests for you tonight as well. Mark Amaru Pinkham is the North American Grand Prior of the International Order of Gnostic Templars. He is an international speaker on the Knights Templar and an author whose books include Guardians of the Holy Grail, The Knights Templar, John the Baptist in the Water of Life, as well as The Return of the Serpents of Wisdom, Conversations with the Goddess and the Truth Behind the Christ Myth. He's back on Coast to Coast. Good to have you back again, Mark. How are you?
I'm excellent, George. It's wonderful to be back.
Likewise. And let me introduce also Sir Andrew Sinclair. He's a Knight Grand Cross in the Scottish Knight Templars, a member of the Clan Sinclair, and one of the driving forces in the clan today. He is one of the world's leading authorities on the Knights Templar, the Holy Grail, and the Holy Grail of the Sinclairs, Roslyn Chapel. His books include The Sword and the Grail, Roslyn, the story of Roslyn Chapel, and the true story behind the Da Vinci Code. We are going live to the United Kingdom. Andrew, how are you?
Very well. Looking forward to the program.
Your family, if I'm reading this right, did they build Roslyn Chapel?
Oh, yes. I mean, they were there for 700 years. They came across in the 11th century. Actually, they were Normans and Vikings, really. And they came across in the 7th century. They brought the Holy Rood across, the piece of the true cross, the most sacred object in Scotland. They built this castle and chapel just south of Edinburgh called Roslyn.
All right, we're going to try to unravel some of the mysteries of Roslyn Chapel. Mark, tell us back, you were with me in September of 2005. Tell us a little bit about your relationship here with Andrew.
Well, Andrew and I are members of the Scottish Knight Templars, which is an order that was founded fairly recently by Ian Sinclair, another member of Clan Sinclair. Ian had been a preceptor of Militi Templi Scotia, which was the main Templar organization in Scotland at the time, and he kind of got disenchanted with that organization, and as actually so did many of the others, and Militi Templi Scotia doesn't have much of a membership these days. But anyway, Ian set off and founded the Scottish Knight Templars with two divisions. One's more of a conservative division, and then there's our division, which is the International Order of Gnostic Templars, and Andrew is a Knight Grand Cross of that organization. I'm a North American Grand Prior. Andrew was present when I received my Grand Priorship up in Scotland, up in Knosshead in northern Scotland, which is our international preceptory where Ian Sinclair lives.
Andrew, tell us, as we get into this, the interest in Roslyn Chapel and its true purpose, why it was constructed.
Well, there was an old chapel in the 12th century. Then in the 15th century, you've got an extraordinary man, William, and he was probably one of the cleverest men in Scotland, and it's an old crusading family, and he decided to build this chapel. They were very rich then, and it is the only stone chapel in the whole of Northern Europe with a stone roof, and it's got the most extraordinary carvings inside, hundreds and hundreds of carvings, green men, temples of Solomon, every sort of carving you can think of. And it is mysterious in this way. It is certainly, in my research, as a chapel of the Grail. And we can talk that later. But it is the most mysterious and strange place. And, of course, with the recent Da Vinci Code, it became even more famous, though I must say that book got it completely wrong. Why? It's a chapel of the Grail.
I mean, that's true. In the novel, toward the last part of his book, if I recall, as he mentions the chapel, he said, one, that it was built by the Knights Templar. That's not accurate, is it?
No, it's not accurate. On the other hand, the Sinclairs were very much Templars. I mean, I made the first great discovery there when I found it was then in a very bad state of repair, and I found a broken tombstone in three pieces. And it said on it, when we put the pieces together, William de Sinclair. Now he died, William de Sinclair, in 1328. And he was one of the four knights taking the Heart of Brutes to Spain. And yet the Templars were officially abolished in 1314. And they really were not meant to be Templars. But on this, and then I found 50 more, was carved the Grail on the stone with a crusading sword by the side. And he was buried in the fashion of a grand prior, a master of the Templars. And there it was. And yet the Templars had been abolished for 20 years.
We think, right?
Well, and we know his story, as I say. It's Sir Walter Scott wrote about it, everyone else. And he was one of the, as I say, four knights who was taking the heart of Bruce. He didn't get further than Spain. He was meant to take it to Jerusalem. And then they were slaughtered. And his bones were returned as often at that time. They just returned the skull and bones of the knights. And that's actually where the pirate cross comes from. You used to cross the bones and put the skull in. So it's quite a small tomb.
But on
these Templar tombs, you will find the Grail. It's carved. And usually in the middle, there's a rosy cross and a great crusading sword by the side.
That's what's so fascinating, I think, about the chapel. The carvings could be messages. For example, Mark and Andrew, there are carvings of what look like American corn in the chapel. And what's so significant about this is that corn wasn't known to Europe at the time, was it?
Absolutely right. It is American corn. And that's the first of my books about it, The Sword and the Grail. That was the grandfather of the man who built the chapel, who was Prince Henry Sinclair. And he, with a couple of Venetian captains, sailed from Orkney. It's called the Zen Voyage or the Zeno Voyage. And it's pretty certain he built that round tower at Newport. There are identical copies of it on Orkney and across France. And it's built in the shape of the Templar chapels. It's an octagon.
And see, the significance of the carvings of American corn, when it wasn't known in Europe for several hundred years later, tells us that somebody either went over to the Americas and witnessed corn or did something, or somebody from the Americas came over to Europe. I don't know which is which. What do you think, Mark Pinkham?
Well, according to legend, Prince Henry Sinclair landed in Nova Scotia, and he spent the winter with the Mi'kmaq Indians, and they have legends of a culture bearer called Glooskap, who came over and taught them many of their mundane and sacred sciences, and then left. And most recently, Niven Sinclair, one of the heads of Clan Sinclair, has been in touch with the chiefs of the Mi'kmaq Indians, and they have actually come to the conclusion that, yes, indeed, Henry Sinclair was their Glooskap. And so there's been a very strong bond that's been created between Clan Sinclair and Mi'kmaq Indians because of that. But besides that, there's also evidence that Henry was over there. They found a 14th century cannon, for example, in the harbor of Louisbourg in Nova Scotia, which would have been used by the Venetians at that time. And Henry was very much connected to the Zeno brothers of Venice, and actually Antonio was his captain. And besides that, you've got what's called the Westford Knight, which is a knight that is actually carved into stone and marks the tomb of one of the gun clan that accompanied Henry over to the New World, and he was second in command. And so there's a lot of evidence, if you study from Nova Scotia down through Massachusetts and into Rhode Island, where you find the structure that Henry supposedly built there that Andrew referred to. So there's a lot of evidence if you start looking around.
Okay, so what then, and you can both jump in here, what do you think the purpose of Roslyn Chapel was. Why did they build it?
It is actually a monument to three extraordinary things. Firstly, it's the Chapel of the Grail. And you know Wagner's Parsifal and all that and all these Grail legends. And another thing, it's the Temple of Solomon. And the third thing it is, with all those carvings of fruit and leaves and green men, it's a sort of Garden of Eden. It's a combination of all three, because the Earl of the time was actually probably one of the most learned men in Europe at the end of the Middle Ages. And he had this huge library or scriptorium, and certainly was something of a mystic. And this is a time when it was really an age of luxury and luxuriance, the waning of the Middle Ages. And he was obviously had a lot of Eastern mysticism in him, indeed, Gnosticism, all these legends from the East. And it is, you can see that it is built on the model of the Temple of Solomon in two great cubes.
Makes you wonder, Andrew, if there's any of Solomon's treasure buried there somewhere.
Ah, well, I'm the man who's meant to have gotten nearest to it. In the end, I firstly did a lot of research on Prince Henry getting across. Then the next thing I did was quite extraordinary. There was a Sinclair conference up in Orkney where Prince Henry had sailed from. And I got into the lodge there and found what subject of my second book on the subject of secret scroll. And this was quite extraordinary because it's 18 foot tall and 6 foot wide. It's the most beautiful medieval scroll of that size, I think, in the whole of Scotland. There's nothing like it. And it's covered with Templar symbols and of the Temple of Solomon and all. They thought it dated from the 18th century. But quite incredibly, I was given by actually a mason, but the local CID man, four pieces of it. And I had it radiocarbon dated by the people who did the Turin Shroud,
yes,
top Oxford lab. And my goodness, it turned out to be 15th century. And that was the time of Earl William. And that was the time in which he had built his chapel. Now, what happened with the Reformation is that Roslyn Castle and Chapel were somewhat spared, but they really wanted to break up all the statues and the monuments. And that whole library was destroyed, Roslyn Castle, by mobs of Protestants from Edinburgh who hated the Catholics and hated all these statues of the Virgin and all the altars and things like that. And they destroyed the library. And I'm pretty certain that he sent this incredible scroll up to the other Sinclair castle in Kirkwall in Orkney, and that's how I got there. And it ended in the lodge. And the most incredible thing about it, if I can go on a bit,
please,
is that in the middle of it, there was a ground plan of the Temple of Solomon. And that ground plan absolutely fitted the ground plan of Roslyn Chapel, down to where the pillars were, everything. Now, this is the remarkable thing. In it, this ground plan of Temple of Solomon, they had two chambers, and we know there are vaults at Roslyn, and the contents of those chambers, incredibly, were the Ark of the Covenant and the Holy of Holies.
Oh, my gosh. So do you remember, Andrew, and Mark, I'm sure you do, the old Indiana Jones movies? Andrew, I don't know if you ever saw any of those, did you?
I did indeed, in one review of my first book, The Sword and the Grail, about this, and then of the secret scroll. And then Roslyn said, Sinclair, they said, he's a cross between Jung and Indiana Jones.
Okay, so I'm talking with an Indiana Jones here.
Well, it, sort of one.
Sort of one. This quest for the Ark of the Covenant, the quest for the Holy Grail, do you really believe in your heart that it is leading us to Roslyn Chapel?
Look, I've got to define this carefully. I've got a big book on the Grail coming out actually in March.
Sure.
And I must tell you what I think the Grail is and why there's so much confusion.
Okay.
About it. First, now, if you can think, let's put it in Christian terms, you think of God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost. Or if you think of it In other terms, there is the Grail, a Grail, and the sort of essence of the Grail.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is, there isn't the Grail. The Grail is the quest for God. That's as simple as that. And it doesn't exist. It's merely you're looking for a piece of divine intelligence. It's God the Father in one sense. It is the quest for divine intelligence. That's what the Grail is. Now, a Grail, oh, there are hundreds of Grails. A Grail is anything which held the body and blood of Christ. And they were so big on relics in the Middle Ages. So it was anything which was said to, oh, have a bit of holy nail or a bit of God's skin, the biggest one, you know, the holy shroud, things of that nature. These are containers, jeweled very often, of something which had something to do with the passion. And the last thing is, this is the odd thing, what I'd call grailness or anything like that. It's when you are looking for the Grail and you have an experience. In all the romances of the Grail, it appeared in so many different forms. It could be even a head on a platter,
mm-hmm.
as well as a jeweled cup. It could be a bleeding spear. It could be practically anything. It was your vision of the Grail. That's why you couldn't ever reach it. It was your quest after God or understanding or wisdom. And that was the third part of the Grail. Now, material Grails, I mean, like the one in Indiana Jones.
Right. The chalice.
Other ones.
Yeah.
You know, that's just an appearance. You can't really hold it. On the other hand, because of all these relics of the Middle Ages, there's one in Valencia, for instance, which, when all these northern Spanish kingdoms were fighting the Moors, and they took Valencia, they were backed by St. Lawrence, who was the only time the Pope sent what was called a Grail across to Spain by legend. It is a sort of Roman glass cup in a holder, and it's really it actually got an Arab inscription on its base, and it is really an object of enormous religious power. That's in Valencia Cathedral. Have great processions with it. Another one at Genoa. Again, a Roman glass cup and all that. And there are many relics all across Europe which are meant to have a piece of the true cross in it. And indeed, the Holy Rood of Scotland is meant to be the true cross. And Sinclair's, to come into a Grail which might be in Rosslyn, two things. One is, they were the official keepers of the royal treasures. So whenever the English attacked Edinburgh, which they did quite often, they'd be taken away, the royal treasures, mm-hmm. including the Rood, into the vault of Rosslyn Chapel. And that is a matter of fact. And the other thing is, with their connections with the Templars, you must understand that the headquarters of the Scots Templars, Temple or Ballantrodach, is only 6 miles from Rosslyn. And they were very closely connected also with the founders of the Templars, the white monks, the Cistercians. So you get this sort of nexus of monks, Templars, and Sinclairs. And it is very likely, again, that the Templars, when they took Constantinople, alas, on the Fourth Crusade, it's very likely they got away with containers of the Holy Shroud and the Holy Veil, which went in different directions.
Hold on, Andrew. We'll be back with you and Mark Pinkham in just a moment. We'll talk about the Shroud and also the Ark of the Covenant with our investigation into Rosslyn Chapel. Back we are with Andrew Sinclair and Mark Pinkham. Mark, where did your interests lie in the Rosslyn Chapel? How did that all begin for you?
Well, George, let me go back to the last question you asked.
All right.
As a way of answering this question. The question was, will the path to the Holy Grail finally culminate in Rosslyn Chapel, which I believe that it will. You know, there are many ways of looking at what the Holy Grail is. Andrew talked about one as being the spiritual path itself. There's another way of looking at it as being the power, the energy, the frequency that surrounds and interpenetrates an object. So you've got the cup of Christ, you've got the nails with the cross, you've got the cross itself, you've got the holy shroud. They all have a certain power attached to them. So when you get in proximity to that power, it works to initiate a process of alchemical unfoldment within you that leads you to immortality. So it's really the way I was trained in the Gnostic path, which I've been part of for many years, and most of my training has been in the East. They say that the true Holy Grail is the power. They call it the Kundalini. In the West, they call it the Holy Spirit, right? That enters you and does the work of transforming you. Now, the Templars, we believe the Templars were part of what we call a Holy Grail lineage, that this power was passed from one Templar Grandmaster to the next. And this lineage actually started in the East. And what we believe is that the Mandean people, they're Gnostic people of southern Iraq, they brought this power and this wisdom from the East. And they eventually merged with the Essenes, and they created the Nazarenes or the Nazarene branch of the Essenes, within which was born John the Baptist and Jesus and John the Apostle. So this power passed from John the Baptist to Jesus, John the Apostle, to Mary Magdalene, and then down a lineage of masters, all who were named John, until the time of the Templars. When the Templars arrived, then Hudapayons became John number 68 of that lineage. And from that point on, that lineage was one and the same with the Templars. I believe that the power of that lineage was the true Holy Grail that the Templars were sworn to protect. Now, I believe that there is wisdom, there is documents about that lineage in Roslyn Chapel today. We have evidence that there are objects that Ian and the Sinclairs and Andrew discovered when they did ground scans on Roslyn. It looks like there's boxes down there. And according to one legend, after 9 years in the Holy Land, the original Templars left the Holy Land with five big cases that we believe eventually ended up in the crypt of Roslyn Chapel, and we believe that those cases were full of documents, Essene documents, documents of that lineage, documents of that Holy Grail lineage that will completely confirm a couple things. One is that there was a long Holy Grail lineage that came from the East that Jesus and John the Baptist and John the Apostle were part of, thus making Jesus one of many sons of God, not the only son of God. And two, it'll prove that the two real successors of Jesus, of his power, of his Gnostic power and wisdom, were Mary Magdalene and John the Apostle, not St. Peter, went a totally different direction and eventually came into the hands of the Templars. And so this whole Johannite lineage, this Gnostic lineage, became the birthright, became the possession of the Templars, and after the Templars, it became the possession of all the secret societies throughout Europe. The Illuminati, the Freemasons, the Rosicrucians, they were all Gnostics that were alchemists, that were trying to transform themselves by creating this power so that they could open themselves to divine wisdom, to Gnosis.
Why can't they find these boxes, Mark and Andrew?
As I said, there was ground scans. Andrew was involved with ground scans to determine what was in the crypt. He also went down into the crypt briefly, and apparently they found some boxes down there, which they believe are those boxes. According to the legend, those boxes ended up in Roslyn Castle, and then there was a big fire in the castle. Those boxes were taken out for safekeeping, and soon after that, they started building Roslyn Chapel. So from some perspective, it looks as though the main reason that they built Roslyn Chapel was to hold those boxes. They were so incredibly valuable.
It's like it was almost like a storage vault for the documents.
Absolutely. I believe it's a storage vault for many things. Certainly the Templars had in their possession many manifestations of the Holy Grail that had that power. They had the Holy Shroud. They had the Mandilion. They also had the head of John the Baptist. They found that during the Fourth Crusade in the same chapel that they found the Holy Shroud. And so they had all these power objects that were continually emanating that energy of the Holy Grail. Even the cup of Christ they had in that position at some point.
Is there something else there, Mark, too? Maybe the Ark of the Covenant hidden
away?
Well,
it's possible. As Andrew was saying, if you look at the secret scroll, it looks as though Roslyn Chapel was actually modeled directly after Solomon's temple, which held the Ark of the Covenant. And so it could be that in that place that Roslyn... that's associated with the the Ark of the Covenant in Solomon's Temple is also there in Roslyn Chapel today, in the crypt. It's a possibility, yes.
How about that, Andrew? Do you think somewhere it might be there?
Yes, well, I mean, it is very likely. We do know that the Templars did escape to the west of Scotland, then to the east. Their main headquarters, they got away about 50 knights and 18 ships, and most of them went to Scotland. Some went down to Portugal and formed the Knights of Christ and discovered Africa and all, and Asia, indeed, for the Portuguese. But the rest went to Scotland because Robert the Bruce needed them, and he was excommunicated himself, so he didn't go with their condemnation. And it is extremely likely that they bought their records, and two things which we know they had, which were grails, and these were the containers of the Holy Shroud, had turned up in Templar hands lately, and of the Holy Veil. Now, as I say, they were the keepers of the royal treasures of Scotland. Whether they had the Ark or not, we don't know. But actually, Mark is totally right. I mean, the Grail is, what I was trying to say, the essence. It's a force. It's a spiritual force. And the Templars, when they had their 90 years in Palestine, in the kingdom of Palestine, and of Jerusalem, they did have very close connections with the Sufis. And I think this sort of mystic gnosis went through the Sufis into the Templars. And they brought back this feeling for a divine force. And this was the quest for the Grail. Now, there's no question that the Sinclairs were keepers of the Templar treasures and the royal treasures. And I was, I think, the only person who's been down into the vault lately. We got 2 nights, 2 days to work on those.
Well, what'd you see down there, Andrew?
Well, I tell you what, we got a ground scan of them, and there are vaults below. And we managed to find a passage at the side, which actually was recorded in the 18th century. And I actually got down there. We took up some flagstones. And then there was a cross-blocking wall, alas, because Walter Scott wrote a poem, I can read you a bit of it, about 20 Sinclair knights, and all being buried, all the heirs of Roslyn, there was a straight bloodline for 700 years, all in the vaults of Roslyn, quoting Scott, seemed all on fire. That's the force of Roslyn,
yeah,
which Mark was talking about. Seemed all on fire, that chapel proud, where Roslyn's chiefs uncoffined lie, each baron for a sable shroud, sheathed in his iron panoply. They were actually buried in their armor down there, and that is a fact. And when finally Cromwell beat them at Dunbar, the last Sinclair knight was buried there. And they closed it up with this wall. Now, I got in at the side of the vault, and I found only 3 coffins and some bones, actually, and this huge wall. We couldn't drill through the wall, nor were we allowed to. But then, most interestingly, I got some oil people in with Niven Sinclair's help, and we drilled through. There is a marker in the middle of the ceiling of Roslyn, which points really at the way where the treasures are or the records.
How did they seal this, Andrew? A long time ago, with
huge stone? Blocks of stone.
Okay.
The whole thing is built in stone.
But so why can't the stone be pulled out?
Because nobody will allow it.
Why?
Because it's like, I mean, supposing somebody said, let's dig up the Capitol to see what's beneath it.
Well, I think if somebody said, my God, there's a chamber here, let's move this stone, I think there might be some support to do that. I mean, I'm sure they wouldn't want the Capitol dismantled, but I think they'd move it around. It's ironic because, you know, we've heard about the Hall of Records being possibly at the foot of the Sphinx. American prophet, the late Edgar Cayce, had visions of that. And I talked to some people just a week and a half ago who have found a chamber there. The Egyptian government won't let them dig either. It's almost as if there's suppression going on.
I agree in a way, but this is historic Scotland. They just won't allow you to do it without 85 archaeologists and this, that, and the other. That's why I was a rather Indiana Jones figure.
Sure, but anyway. I'm sure you can get these 85 geologists there if everyone was prepared to go in there and take a look.
Yes. What we did, though, we did drill through the flagstones, and we put down something called an endoscope, which takes photographs below.
Right.
And alas, the rubble kept on filling up. It's filled up with rubble below.
So you couldn't really see anything in there.
But it is pretty certain, because we have 18th century evidence, certainly the knights are down there. Certainly the Holy Rood disappeared after the last English sack of Edinburgh in 1544. And so it is extremely probable that certainly the Holy Rood and Templar records are down there. But to get historic Scotland or the present Earl of Rosslyn to agree to it, that's another matter.
How about you, Mark? Your thoughts on just why we can't go there and
pull
the rocks away?
I think one of the main reasons is that the Sinclairs aren't the owners of Rosslyn Chapel anymore. It's the Erskine clan. What reason does the Erskines have to go down there? They're making money hand over fist with the way things are right now, and looks as though they'd just as soon stay with the status quo. What's down there is Sinclair history. It's not Erskine clan history. It's Sinclair clan history. If the Sinclairs, I believe the Sinclairs were in possession of it today, it'd be opened up yesterday because what is down there is very valuable to them, and they want to bring it to light at this point. I talked to Ian Sinclair yesterday, as I often speak to him, about Rosslyn Chapel, and he said that he was recently sitting with Earl Malcolm Sinclair, who's the head of Clan Sinclair today, and he brought up the question of Rosslyn Chapel. Will it go back into the hands of Sinclair? And Earl... Earl Malcolm says believes that it actually will in time, and when that happens, then I believe that almost immediately we're going to be able to get down there.
In U.S. dollars, Andrew, how much do you think Rosslyn Chapel is worth?
Well, it's beyond price. It's like, to me, it's as important as the Vatican is to the Pope.
Sure.
This is the most ornamented stone chapel in the whole of Western Europe. And, it is a chapel of the Grail, and it is certainly for Templars and people they passed on many of their secrets to, Masons. It is built as a Temple of Solomon. You've got on the west thing, you can see two pillars, Jachin and Boaz, holding up the stone roof. And it's where Eastern wisdom got through the Templars into the Masonic movement. And in that way, it's probably the most valuable chapel for all Masons in the world.
Might there be something else there, too? Something we probably haven't even thought of? I mean, as strange as this may sound, records from Atlantis, earlier civilizations, who knows what? The secrets of how the pyramids were built?
Well, if it's true that what's under there is what was found by the Knights Templar digging around the foundations of Solomon's Temple for 9 years, and apparently knowing what they were digging for, because they dug down through solid bedrock down as much as 20 feet to find what they found and bring it back and store it in Rosslyn Chapel. There's something extremely, extremely valuable there, and I believe that it was whatever it was known by the royal families of Europe, who actually were descended by the royal families and the elder families of the Jews. And of course, the Jewish connection goes back to Moses Moses goes back to Egypt. And so there's no question that it could be some scrolls, it could be some information about Atlantis.
It's just incredible. And if for some reason, some believe the Ark of the Covenant is in Ethiopia, but if for some reason it is there, hidden away there somewhere, and it does still possess, for example, the Ten Commandments that Moses brought down from the Mount. I mean, that's incredible. What a find. Andrew, you got to find this.
Well, I had a shot at it for 48 hours without sleep excavating, but I just would never get permission again. And there we are. We caused a terrific scandal. I think they thought when we were doing it, lights all night. We were having sort of satanic orgies in there. But in point of fact, it would, to get it done now, indeed, Mark's right, it's not a Sinclair property anymore. At the end of the 18th century, it went to the Erskines and the Wedderburns, because the Sinclair bloodline of 700 years was finished just with women. But at this point, I think it's incredibly important to bring it up. And I've tried, other thing I'm trying to do is to get the secret scroll preserved, this incredible medieval document, but it's very difficult dealing with local people, you know. We've managed to get the Westford Knight preserved, and I'm trying to get the secret scroll preserved. It is so important, and it is a treasure map. And it is, to me, remarkable that you can have these quests and you can't achieve them. My last book, Roslyn, I mean, it's all about this form of quest. I don't feel frustrated in a sense, but I am a Sinclair. I do feel with Malcolm and Ian Sinclair and the rest of us, we feel very strongly that this excavation should be done. If you get into bureaucracy and things like that, it's almost impossible.
Yeah, it is just amazing to me how some of the greatest mysteries of this planet, of all mankind, get suppressed because somebody or some group just doesn't want the information out. Which leads me, I guess, Mark, to a question like this. Why do they want it suppressed? I mean, what's the real reason here?
Well, I believe, why do they want the information about Roslyn, why do they want the wisdom that's contained within Roslyn suppressed? Is because it's Gnostic wisdom. It's throughout the history, the fundamentalist patriarchal churches, the Catholic Church, have done their utmost in order to suppress the Gnostic movements, because they were all about opening oneself to the wisdom within and having that direct personal experience with the divine without any intermediary, without any priest. And we saw what happened with the Cathars in the Languedoc in the 13th century. They were totally exterminated, total genocide. Why? Because not only were they opening themselves up to the divine, but they were also inviting many other people in their area, in the Languedoc, to come and participate in what they were doing. And the Catholic Church says, well, we don't want that. Those should be our people. And we also want all that land that the Cathars are taking over. That should be our land. Okay?
It's totally true. I'm sorry if I come in here. The whole quest for the Grail is your personal quest, without church or state, to get to the mind of God. That's what it is. And Mark's absolutely right. And the problem with Scotland was the Reformation. They had 16 beautiful abbeys, every one destroyed. The only place they didn't destroy, because it had Masonic connections, was Roslyn Chapel.
Stay with us, Andrew. Stay with us. We're going to take this break. We're at the top of the hour here in the United States. We'll be back. You and Mark, of course, will be with us for two more hours. When we come back, we'll finish up on this dialogue, then also talk about the Knights Templar. Who were they? Did they come to America? And also the Shroud. Where is it? Is it really in Turin? I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Mark Pinkham, Andrew Sinclair. Andrew, of course, is in the United Kingdom. Mark is here in the United States as we talk about Roslyn Chapel. Andrew, the break was getting us as you were talking about Roslyn Chapel. We were talking about the efforts to try to get in there. It's not going to happen. Are you going to go back at all? Can you go back?
I can't go back. I don't think they'd have me. But I must just tell you, what we were talking about before was the suppression of these things, why it's so difficult. The problem in Scotland was the Reformation. And when John Knox and everyone got in, and the Presbyterians, everything else, they smashed every religious statue they could find.
Literally
and
smashed.
Destroyed, yeah. It was called, they just smashed that beautiful architecture. I mean, Scotland had more abbeys and chapels than anywhere else in, far more than England, all along the borders and everything else. They were all reduced to ruins, and you lost the most wonderful architecture of the Middle Ages. And this was an idea that you really shouldn't show God, you shouldn't have Virgin Marys, you should smash the lot. And the Presbyterian chapels were just plain, painted white walls, a small pulpit, and that's it. You weren't allowed to show anything religious. It had to be plain and straight. And so when I found this first Grail stone with the crusading sword and the Grail stone of William de Sinclair in Rosslyn, I then went all along the borders to all the old abbeys, and I found them smashed, these Grail stones, with the Grail on it and the crusading sword, all across in about 15 different places. They were used just as borders for paths. They were built in as lintels over doorways. And they just destroyed the Templars, and they destroyed every memory of the Catholic past. I mean, the worst thing with the Masons is, for instance, all the Catholic records of the early Masons and the Templars were all destroyed. There may be a few left in the vaults of Rosslyn Chapel. But the object was to rewrite the past, and that's what the Protestants did.
All right, let's talk a little bit, if we can, about the Knights Templar. Who were they?
Well, they began, they were founded, curious enough, by St. Bernard, who founded of Clairvaux. He founded the White Monks, and then he thought, I'd better have an armed fist for the White Monks. So he founded the Templars. There were only nine of them, as Mark was saying, out of Hugh de Payen. They were out. They were protectors of pilgrims, was their job.
Soldiers, basically.
Yeah, and they protected pilgrims, and they became so popular that they were given, in the end, they had 9,000 manors and commanderies across Europe, 9,000, and they were actually the first bankers, securicorps. They would transport money from place to place and give it back again.
Were they priests first?
They were the only people, other than the Catholic Church, allowed to give communion to each other. And that is why they were destroyed. They were a state within the state. They were very wealthy. And in the end, they were self-governing.
Wasn't it a Friday the 13th that they were annihilated?
Yes, in 1307. And they were tortured and had to confess to crimes they hadn't done. Their only crime was, indeed, exactly the crime of the all the knights in the Crusades and in the medieval Grail romances. They could get to God directly without church or state, and that was their crime.
Mark, your research into the Templars, what does it show you?
Well, what my research has shown is that they were a lot more than just guardians of the pilgrims coming and going to the Holy Land. It appears as though that they dug around Solomon's Temple for 9 years as an example and came up with a lot of documents, Gnostic documents, a lot of treasures, treasures of the Jewish temples, perhaps documents of the Essenes. You know, one reason that we believe this is that when the Templars left the Holy Land, the legend has it that they left with five cases, five big boxes. As they were moving up to Europe, they stopped in Flanders and in Omers, which was the hometown of Geoffrey d'Omers, one of the original nine knights. And one of the scrolls that they were taking with them was copied by a man named Lambert d'Omers. And this scroll is still around today, this copy, rather. And it hangs in the Library of the University of Ghent in Belgium, and what it depicts is the heavenly Jerusalem. And according to the scriptures, according to prophecy, the heavenly Jerusalem is the new world that the Messiah comes to create. Well, if you study this particular copy, what you find is that Jesus is nowhere to be found, which is interesting. He's supposedly the Messiah. Well, what you find is that John the Baptist is apparently referred to as the founder of the heavenly Jerusalem. Now, this is true Gnostic wisdom, and it confirms this idea that we have that the Templars thought of John as something greater, something higher than even Jesus, not because he was higher in his consciousness or power, but he preceded Jesus in this Holy Grail, this Johannite lineage that the Templars became the guardians of. And so my feeling is that what the Templars were involved in was a lot of Gnostic and alchemical rites. Certainly they lost they learned a lot from the Sufis, but they also gained this wisdom through this Gnostic lineage that came through Jesus and John the Apostle and Mary Magdalene. So they were involved with these rites when they went back into Europe in their preceptories. And this is what brought about their downfall. I mean, really what brought about their downfall was that King Philip the Fair of France wanted their money. But how he went about getting it was by infiltrating the preceptories of the Templars with 12 spies, and the spies could oversee these Gnostic rites, these Gnostic ceremonies the Templars were deeply involved in, and then report back to the king. And then the king, of course, would felt as though he had the right at that point to go in and bring down the order. And he had at the time, Clement V on his side, Pope Clement V. Some of these rites, these Gnostic rites, such as what they call a Templar kiss, where I believe that the master Templar was breathing through his breath, he was transferring this energy, this Gnostic Holy Grail energy, into the new knight. He also kissed him below the navel, the base of the spine, and these are seats of this Gnostic energy, this Kundalini energy. And they also were worshiping these grotesque sort of images, which some refer to as the Baphomet. And these grotesque images are very demonic because they represent the destructive power of this Kundalini. See, in the East, they love the gods of destruction because they believe that these gods of destruction destroy everything. They keep a person from knowing their divine nature. But in the West, we eschew the gods of destruction. We hate the gods of destruction because it's ruled over by patriarchy. Patriarchy wants to keep the status quo through its technology. It doesn't like destruction, you see. And so I think that so if you study the deeper meanings of the Templars and you go into studying about Eliphas Levi and some of these others who were apparently privy to some of the secret rites of the Templars, you find this Gnostic tradition, this Gnostic alchemical tradition there. And then, and if you look also into the secret societies that they spawned, the Rosicrucians, the Illuminati, you find the same thing. It's alchemy and gnosis, and this is what they were all about.
I don't remember which Indiana Jones it was. I think it was Indiana Jones in the Last Crusade, where he was looking for the Holy Grail. I'm pretty sure it was that one. But Andrew, they had a statue that became real. I think it was depicting a Knights Templar guarding the Holy Grail. Do you remember that one?
Yes, I do. The interesting thing about that was, as Mark said, they made the Grail a sort of possessed of an electric force, some sort of rather like a flash of lightning. It was surrounded by this electric force, and actually, it's very interesting. When they built the original Temple of Solomon, or the Grail Temple, they actually did it by something called a shamir, which was, they didn't want any iron to cut the stone, and they did it by a form of directed fire. And these are the smelting works, actually, of King Solomon, where he got copper for the temple from it and brass. And it's this particular life force or energy, which I think in the Indiana Jones, they said that was in the Grail and in the Ark of the Covenant. And I think you'll find in all the Grail romances, and it's still actually in the Kaaba of Mecca, and it was always the thing that it's meteorites. And basically, I think all the Grail legends come to being meteorites. These are things fallen from heaven with a force and energy which can be passed on. And Mark's right. I mean, basically what we call the kiss of life now. You know, somebody gets drowned, you try to breathe back into him.
True.
Life. And that's actually what the Cathars did. It was called the Consolamentum, the Holy Kiss. And the Templars got it from the Cathars. Basically, you're trying to breathe that energy, which is in the Grail, the force of life, into an initiate.
How big, Andrew, I guess if you could describe it for us, how big is Roslyn Chapel?
It's quite small. Now, when I first went there, and this was, 15 years ago, it was actually meant to be five times larger. This was one of the crosses of the cross but they only finished a fifth of it. And when I went there originally, it was deserted. There was moss inside the ceiling. Everything was smashed, but it had an incredible presence about it. You could go there and commune and see that this was part of nature, as well as a chapel of the Grail. Now, I'm afraid, it is almost unendurable because of the crowds from the Da Vinci Code. I think you should pay a congestion charge to get in.
What does it cost to get in there?
It's £7 or something.
Now, how much? How much?
Ridiculous.
How much? Well, how much is that?
And you know, you can't get in. It's a small and holy place. In fact, the priest looking after it has resigned. He can't have any sense of God in his left.
All right, now, what's £7? You said how much is that in
dollars?
It's
about $12.
Oh, okay.
It's a lot, and you know, it's just too small. It's also been filled with chairs and everything else. When it was empty and decaying, it really was extraordinary. You could feel a force in there. But it's sort of lost in crowds, as so many places are.
Is it like a two-level house, or is it bigger than that?
No. It's about the size of a barn, a big barn.
A big barn, okay.
You know, in Amish country.
But it's all stone.
It's all stone, and it's the only place with a stone roof. It's supported on 14 pillars. As I said, the opening, the facade, is indeed, you know, Jachin and Boaz and the stone roof. It's an exact model of the original Temple of Solomon, as far as we know.
Has it been modernized? I mean, has it got electrical?
It has been modernized. It's going at the moment through a refit. They're redoing rather badly all the old statues and everything else outside.
I heard of
And it's going through a refit. It's surrounded by a steel corset, really. And you've got an awful sort of rubber dunce's cap over the whole roof while they redo it.
I had heard that there's a pillar there called the Apprentice Pillar or the Prentice Pillar. There's a neat story about a mason went away and the young apprentice worked on it and did a great job. And he came, but the mason came back. He was so upset because it looked so good. He killed the apprentice or hit him over the head with a mallet.
Yes, that's the great connection with the mason. I was actually knighted by the Apprentice Pillar. It's sometimes called the Prince's Pillar, too. But that story is true. And really, that's why it's so holy to the masons. It goes back to Hiram Abiff being killed by three people who are jealous of his secrets of construction. It's terribly important to the Masons, and it was important to the Templars, too, because that's John the Baptist. It's the head of John the Baptist, quite rightly. People they really worshipped were John the Baptist and Mary Magdalene, the bearer of the Grail in the Gnostic Gospels.
Do you believe we will ever get to the bottom, literally, of Roslyn Chapel?
I'll tell you something. It's rather like the quest for the Grail. I don't want to get there.
Why?
It's like you said in your program. I think people should go there and wonder and read about it and come to their own conclusions. But the thing I am certain about is it is a chapel of the Grail. It's actually, it's the Grail of the original Parsifal. You will see on the top right-hand corner the moon pouring out and God and the dove coming down and all that. That's carved in the top right-hand corner of the ceiling. There also is a Knights Templar riding there with an angel and a cross behind him. There are many Templar symbols. And it is, for those who are interested in the Templars and all Masons, it is the proof of how the Templar wisdom, Eastern wisdom, went into the Masons and has been preserved, at least in the ancient Scottish rites, as they call it. And to me, though, it is a mystery which can't be solved. Because even if we dug down, even if we found, we'll certainly find the knights in their armor there, and if we find the boxes of records, or the Holy Rood, all that, these are only, I think your voyage towards divine intelligence, these are only symbols on the way towards it. And we must find that way if we're interested.
Mel Gibson starred in a movie called Braveheart, again here in this country. He played the part of William Wallace. Would he have been alive during the period of Roslyn Chapel?
No, because that was then a Benedictine chapel. It wasn't built till 200 years later.
But, okay.
But the interesting person is the person who followed Wallace, is Robert the Bruce. Because in the time of Robert the Bruce...
Now, Robert the Bruce was in that movie, though. So I guess they played a little bit with history.
Yeah, well, anyway, he then defeated the English, the famous Battle of Bannockburn, and made Scotland independent. And the Templars fought for him at Bannockburn because they were excommunicated in England.
Interesting. When we come back, I want to talk about the Shroud and get your take, both your take on all of this. Mark, are you going back there at all?
Am I going back to Roslyn?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll be there many times. Our international headquarters is up in Knoss Head, where we have our where Ian Sinclair is a preceptory. But certainly, I want to be back there. I want to be right in the middle of what's going on, because I do believe that sooner or later we are going to be able to get into the crypt. And I think it's very important that we do get down there, because I do think that there are documents that speak about this lineage, that Jesus, John the Apostle, John the Baptist, Mary Magdalene were part of this Gnostic Holy Grail lineage. It shows that there's a connection between East and West. It shows that Jesus is not the one and only Son of God. It shows that the true lineage came through John and Mary Magdalene. It was a Gnostic tradition, and it was all about having a direct personal experience of the divine without having an intermediary. I think this is very, very important, and I think that when it's probably going to open up is pretty soon, because I think that according to prophecy, there's only going to be supposed to be two more popes,
yeah,
in the Catholic Church, and after that, people are going to be on their own. They're going to be searching. They're going to say, okay, well, what do we do now? Where do we go now? And we want to be ready for that at that time. And we want to say, yes, Jesus Christ was a great master. Yes, he certainly was. And we worship him and venerate him as a great master. But he wasn't the only one and only Son of God. There are many sons of God. And the East and West are connected. And they're all traditions, all religions have the same essence. They all lead to the same place. And they were all one at one time originally. And so I think this is absolutely imperative that we do get down there and we do get to those records.
What's your latest work, Mark?
My latest work, strangely enough, and even I think it's a bit strange, that I'm working on a book on giants.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Got to get you back for that one.
Yeah, well, I hope to, yeah.
Okay, very good. Mark, stay with us. You as well, Andrew. We're going to come back. We'll talk about the Shroud. That has always fascinated me. The next hour, they will both be here to take your phone calls. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Andrew, did the Templars have a fleet of ships? And if so, whatever happened to them?
Yes. I mean, once they lost Jerusalem, they went down to Acre and they took to the sea. And they were taught, they really were the best fleet of the time, they and the Hospitallers. They took to the sea, and they actually were the first people to use maps. And these first maps we have, sea maps, are of the 13th century when the Templars had it. And indeed, when they were destroyed, some of the ships went from France down to Portugal. And actually, the Templars then became the Knights of Christ. And with Vasco da Gama and the rest of them, they had the same Templar emblem on their sails. They discovered for the first time Africa, and indeed they got as far as Asia. They were the great ships of Henry the Navigator. But those who got to Scotland weren't very many. There wasn't much of a Scots navy then, but they were the people who brought across the records to Roslyn.
Now let's talk a little bit about the Shroud. Was it, first of all, the responsibility of the Templars to take possession of the Shroud, to guard it? And if so, how did they come to be? How did they get it?
Look, this is actually a matter of history. In the Fourth Crusade, we should have gone to Jerusalem. Instead, the Pope wanted to get rid of the Greek version of Christianity, so it took Constantinople. And there the Shroud and the Holy Veil were. They were in two chapels in Mary Blacherni. And the Templars got hold of them. We know they got hold of the Shroud because in 1307, when they were destroyed in Paris, it turned up later, the Shroud, the same name, somebody called Geoffrey de Charnay, it turned up later at Charnay in a chapel there about 50 years later. And this was recognized. It then was later reached Milan and Turin. And this is what happened to the Shroud. It is a Templar family which actually had the Shroud in the middle of the century. The man who had it actually died at a battle against the English, Battle of Poitiers, and he was carrying the great sacred banner of France, the Oriflamme. But he held the shroud, the Chani's, at this little town for about 200 years. Then it got to the House of Savoy and ended up in Turin.
Now, what we have seen is the Shroud of Turin. Do you believe it is authentic or that it's some kind of medieval forgery?
It's very like my discovery of the secret scroll. Now, they have taken the same lab which identified my secret scroll as 15th century and therefore possibly, you know, the grand plan of Rosslyn and where the Grail is. The great Oxford lab, somebody called Teddy Hall, they dated the Shroud of Turin. Three labs did it. But they only had bits from the edge, which weren't in good condition.
Right.
They did not have bits from the center. So they said it was a forgery of the 8th century. But if it had bits from the center, they might have come up with a conclusion, as my Kirkwall scroll did, the secret scroll. They could have found something, and there is something inexplicable about the center. It has been analyzed, and in its dyes, which are vegetable dyes, as well as blood and sweat, there are plants, it's rather like Rosslyn Chapel, which only existed in Palestine in the first century.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know. It's unproven. The tests done on it have only been from the edge. Nobody has tested the center.
What do you think? What's your gut tell you, Andrew?
I think it's, again, rather like your program. I think that there was a shroud. The one in Constantinople was got from Edessa in the 8th century, and the Christians took the city from the Muslims and they took away the shroud. And to me, I'll tell you, it's like all the symbols for the Grail. If you believe this is the shroud, it is the shroud. Belief makes things. And as it is unproven, I prefer the belief.
How about you, Mark?
Well, I come from a rather unique perspective. I've actually heard it from Mandeans. You see, the Mandeans are the Gnostic sect that say that John the Baptist and Jesus were part of their sect. According to some of them, the shroud is actually an image of not Jesus but John the Baptist. And look at it closely, and you can see that there is a severed head. Okay, well, that makes sense. But he's also you find that the image is wearing what's called a padan. It's kind of a loincloth that the Mandean priests wear. And see, the thing of it is, John the Baptist was a Mandean priest. Jesus wasn't. So from that perspective, Jesus wouldn't have been wearing that padan. You see, Jesus, he actually broke all the rules of the Mandean priesthood by, for example, baptizing in stagnant water, things like that. Not just mm-hmm. him, but of course his apostles as well. And so he's not looked upon as a Mandean priest. He's looked upon as a great Mandean, what they call Nasarai, a great enlightened master, but not a priest. And so would he have been wearing the priest of a would he have been wearing the clothes of a Mandean priest? Well, no, he wouldn't have.
It is another one of those great mysteries. I remember the very first time I did a full program on the Shroud of Turin, and I looked at it, and I just looked at these pictures, and for an artist to forge it, he had to be pretty darn good. And I don't know if they had the ability then, did they? Could they have forged it?
They didn't have the ability then. I mean, in point of fact, you could not have reproduced it when it was, you know, discovered. At the time, you couldn't do that sort of thing. It is blood and sweat. You simply couldn't have done it.
Now, the mystery of Rosslyn Chapel, if it leads us to some of what the Da Vinci Code movie and the book were all about, some accuracy there, what does that tell us about past history? I mean, what don't we know? What has changed?
Well, the great thing is this thing about the holy blood. And whether there is a direct bloodline. Now, the Priory of Zion and all that is total nonsense. That was an invention, a rather recent one. And when you have people like Cocteau, as well as Leonardo da Vinci, and all these great minds, Newton and the rest of it, that's just nonsense. Now, there are a couple of Sinclairs in it. But that isn't true. Now, the great heresy is, of course, that, you see, Mary Magdalene, I mean, I've seen her 150 representations of her carrying a grail all across the cathedrals of Europe. That's the Gnostic Gospel. Came with Joseph Arimathea to the south of France. They bore the grail. Now, the grail they bore was the blood of Christ. That's the Gnostic belief. Now, the next thing which happened was, it's really modern feminism as much as anything else, was the grail is also the womb, you know, and that is the womb of a woman, and that's Mary Magdalene, the sinner. Now, both of these beliefs, and goes back to being an earth goddess, it dates back to the Egyptians, the idea of the grail as the womb and the life bearer. But this got confused. Actually, for the first time, about 400 years ago, somebody called John Harding confused it with the Holy Grail, the Sang Graal, with the Sang Royal, the royal blood in French. And so this idea came out that Mary Magdalene actually had a child by Jesus. And this heresy has been running around for about 400 years. And, you know, in all these medieval grail romances, they like to say Galahad, for instance, was, you know, meant to be the ninth person in the line from Jesus and the house of Judah. And you find this royal or divine origin to the Knights of the Grail and all the romances. The idea has been around a long time. It's only become very strong recently.
Do you believe the royal family of England, they were descendants from this bloodline?
Well, I mean, in you know, the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail and all that, it's Mary Magdalene and the Levites into the old French kings, the Merovingians, and so on and so forth through the Normans. But there you are. I mean, I honestly tell you how far it's gone, and this is true. I was telephoned by the National Geographic Channel, who are making a film, and they said, Andrew, would you be DNA tested, being a Sinclair, Sancto Claro, Holy Light, for the blood of Jesus? So I began to laugh. I said, where are you going to get the blood of Jesus from? The Holy Shroud? There you are.
I love the mystery, though.
Well, I didn't get DNA tested, but I know that some members of my clan did.
Mark, here's another mystery then. Will this one ever be uncovered? Will we ever get the real answer?
The real answer to the Holy Bloodline?
Yes.
That's very, very difficult. I mean, what my research has shown is, and I think the research of many people out there, is that you can go back as far as the Merovingians, but after that it's a total blur. It's a total gray area. There really aren't any enduring documents, unless, of course, they are under Roslyn Chapel. And that's what we've kind of got our fingers crossed, that that perhaps they are there. And I just wanted to mention that one thing that Roslyn is going to reveal to the world about the Earth's history is that originally spirituality was Gnosticism. It was about going out and having that direct experience of the divine without an intermediary, because it's going to talk about this Holy Grail lineage that came from the East. It came from the goddess tradition. It came from the matriarchal tradition. Within that tradition was Gnosis. And if you go into Roslyn Chapel, everywhere you look, you see the green man, and you see symbols of the goddess as the rose and the five-pointed star. That it is, it's also the chapel of the goddess, you know. It also had a big black Madonna in the center of it and a labyrinth on the floor. These are all symbols of the goddess, and they're all alchemical Gnostic symbols as well. And so this was a tradition that preceded all the patriarchal Orthodox traditions on the planet. Today, we know that. If you go back to the Neolithic age, it was the goddess. It was like they say when God was a woman. It's the goddess tradition. The goddess tradition even today is about going out and having that direct personal experience of the divine. And that's true, pure spirituality without any dogma whatsoever. And this is what it's going to show. It's going to show this was the original pure spirituality, and it's time to get back to that.
Now, the family that owns Andrew Rosslyn Chapel right now, is this a small clan or is it a large family?
Well, at the end of the 18th century, the last Sinclair of Rosslyn, actually, he was the first Grand Master of all the Scots Masons, too. That's the connection. He had daughters, and they married into the Wedderburns and the Erskines. So it's in the last 200 years, it's really a member of the Erskine clan. And it's really up to him to do something. But he's accepted a great deal of money from Historic Scotland to redo up Rosslyn, I think, not very well. And there you are. He's stuck now between bureaucrats and everything else, having taken this money to restore the chapel.
Just amazing research for both of you. Andrew, what about some of your work? Where can people find your book?
Oh, well, Amazon, I suppose. I did a Rosslyn trilogy, the Sword and the Grail, the Secret Scroll, and Rosslyn. You can get from them. They're all on Amazon. There's no problem about them. The next one, though, is the most interesting of all. I've produced a book just called The Grail, The Quest for a Legend. It's coming out in March here. And it is the most illustrated book on the Grail since the Middle Ages. It's got 250 illustrations.
And you believe there's not just one Grail?
There are many Grails. I said there is the Grail, which is the sort of message from God. There are A Grails, and that's anything, like the containers of the Holy Shroud and the Holy Veil, the Holy Rood. There are hundreds of these, because the Middle Ages loved relics of the Passion, and they put them into these jeweled caskets. But you'll notice in the medieval romances, nobody reaches the Grail. It's carried in by, I mean, Mark's absolutely right, carried in by an earth goddess, and it feeds everyone or cures wounds and does things like that. But it's women who bear it. That's what's so interesting about it. And it represents, indeed, creation through the womb and all that. But then there is what I believe it is. It is our personal quest for divine intelligence. And it may come down as a dove or a cup or a platter and cure us all. But there are hundreds of symbols of it. That's why, indeed, my book has all these illustrations of it.
Now, earlier we talked about the possibility that somebody discovered the Americas way before Christopher Columbus. Do you think that's possible, and who might that have been?
Well, indeed. I mean, I wrote this whole book, The Sword and the Grail, about it, which was very popular. It is Prince or Earl Henry Sinclair, and he has two Venetian navigators. It was I who found that 14th century cannon at Louisbourg, and then the Westford Knight, and then again really reevaluated the Newport Tower at Rhode Island and found it was exactly the same shape with its eight doors within a circle, the octagon, which the Templars always built in. They built in octagons from the Dome of the Rock all the way through from that example, and all their chapels are octagons, basically, with eight entrances. And the Newport Tower is definitely a form of fortified church, and a lighthouse, I may say, and its most likely founder was Prince or Earl Henry Sinclair sailing from Kirkwall, where indeed I found that secret scroll and the map of Rosslyn and everything else. I mean, and what was he trying to do? Well, actually, he was founding before Columbus went across.
And that's about 100 years before Columbus, right?
Yes, 100 years before. Before Columbus went across, Henry was terribly powerful. He was number three. They had this. At the time, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden were all combined, and the trade was to the north. It was timber, furs, salt fish, and resin for ships. And there was a huge Viking trade across the Atlantic. There was a Viking settlement in Newfoundland. So we know that this was going on. And I think Henry went out, if you take as a bearer of the Grail, he's certainly, like his grandson who built our chapel, he was a very learned man. He'd been on a crusade. He knew of Eastern wisdom. He was certainly trying to found a colony out there because he went out with monks and people like that. And if the Grail crossed the Atlantic, it would have crossed it then.
Amazing.
The search for divine intent.
What kind of a ship would he have had?
Oh, these were adapted Viking ships. They had two forms of it. They had galleys, which wouldn't have been useful. And they had these ships called Anors. They were single or double-sailed ships. And they'd been carrying on this northern trade with Greenland, Iceland, Newfoundland for about three or four centuries.
All right, well, you stay with us. We're going to take phone calls when we come back next hour. Now, Mark's website is GnosticTemplars.org. That's linked up at CoastToCoastAM.com. Andrew does not have a website that we're putting up here, but I will ask you, Andrew, do you have a website?
Yes, there's one, well, two. There's one called AndrewSinclairTemplar.com.
Andrew Sinclair Templar.
Templar.
Okay, no S, Templar.com. Okay, Lex, you can take that and link that up on CoastToCoastAM.com. Let's come right back. Now we'll open up the phone lines. I know you have a lot of questions for these two. We'll do that next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're going to take your phone calls, and by the looks of things, they're piling in. So this hour will go by very quickly. You can address who you'd like to ask this question to. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. Who are you calling for?
Oh, thanks for taking my call. My call's for Andrew Sinclair.
Okay, sure.
I've been doing family genealogy for like over 15 years, and I have a line of family history. Starts out with the Houdans, did Bolio, and it goes all the way to this Catherine Ballion, and they claim that she's like a gateway. They've done spent lots of money on research, like $4,000, because she's kind of like a connection to the gateway to these Marubian kings. It leads to Mary
Magdalene, as some people would say.
Right. And I'm just wondering if this is this true, or are they pulling my leg, or what? And I also have Sinclairs in my family history, although they go through the Canadian Quebec area, through the Fairbanks, which is also English. I mean, I have papers and documents dating back to like 1035. So, I mean, I have a lot of stuff.
Okay, Andrew, chat with her.
Yes, there's a huge amount of families looking back to see if they're part of the Holy Blood. And as I say, it's claimed that the Sancto Clares are, we know, Prince Henry went across. There are books on the Grail across the Atlantic. Though they don't always say, but it's very likely that Henry and the people with him would have done a little bit of intermarriage, this, that, and the other. And there were a lot of people who did go across to Canada. How the Grail got there, I don't believe that it went there in other than faith, just to search for divine intelligence and this idea. But whether you can connect yourself with one of the families of the Holy Blood, Sinclairs are one of them or claim to be, I really haven't seen all your heredity work.
Okay, is there a place where I can send paperwork that I do have so that someone can check it out to see if it's real?
Well, you can go, there are records over here, you know, of genealogy and family and all. They're all on websites. And, you know, there's a huge amount of research going on. Millions of people have tried to get across. At Galashiels, for instance, there's a history of all the border families. And that's a very good place to go. All the borderers, I think 3 million presently came from border families. A lot went to Canada. You'll find an awful lot of Sinclairs in Canada.
Well,
and
no,
you've really
I have
got to come back and do the research in Scotland.
I already have history. These papers come from France. I mean, they're like lords and dukes and earls, and all the stuff is in this paperwork. I have, like, there's 40 pages on this particular family.
Well, there you are. I mean, that's the same as the Sinclairs. We have hundreds of pages on it, full of dukes and earls and explorers and even a prince. But there we are. I mean, I can only comment is I do think it's worth looking for your roots and looking for it that way.
Does anybody authenticate papers like that in documents, Andrew?
Yes, I mean, they're all available. You just have to do an awful lot of research on it. I've spent nearly 20 years of this. I know a little about it and the family and Ross Lynn. It just takes a lot of work and a lot of old archives and that.
All right, very good. Thanks for that question. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Good morning.
Yes, George, wonderful show. I'm really enjoying it.
Thank you.
I saw a movie a while back. It's been about 3 or 4 years ago, and the movie was about they discovered some bones that was buried in Jerusalem in a secret tomb. And the whole movie was based upon if they trying to prove it was Jesus' bones or not. And they was kind of, you know, keeping it under wraps and trying to prove it one way or the other. And toward the very end of the movie, they disproved it. It was a hoax. It was somebody who was crucified the same way and so forth. But could it possibly be something and to that effect that they might have the bones of Jesus, that they will say that this is Jesus' bones to try to, in a way, disprove Christianity as a whole and to bring in the New World Order?
Well, this was the medieval cult of relics, and there were 3 claimed heads of John the Baptist, for instance, skulls of him, and many pieces of what they claimed were the holy nails and bits of bone of Jesus and all. Now, whether these are authentic or not, we don't know. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre was founded as the Empress Helena got out there. And she came from Constantinople just when they were converted to Christianity. And she found the tomb of Jesus. Now, that was opened. And certain skeletons were found there. And these remnants came back to Constantinople. Now, whether this was the tomb of Jesus or not, we don't know. Anyway, that's where the Church of Holy Sepulchre still is, and if you go to Jerusalem, you can visit the tomb of Jesus. And these relics, or bits of bone, were widely scattered, particularly of John the Baptist, St. Paul, St. Peter, all these people. They left it, and there were bones of Jesus claimed. There were even claims, you know, of putting in a relic of the Virgin's milk, which fed Jesus. And indeed of Jesus' foreskin taken at the time of his circumcision. That was in Charoux. Charlemagne had it. So you had all these claims for bones of Jesus or bits of Jesus. But there we are. I don't know. The Middle Ages believed in them. We don't tend to believe in them so much now.
Right. I don't, of course, I'm a Christian. But I believe this would be something. I just got through reading Bill Cooper's book, Behold a Pale Horse.
Mm-hmm. The late Bill Cooper.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I've noticed on, I think it was page 76 or so, he discussed the Grail, and he did mention that they had someone's bones buried in France that they had and was going to bring out eventually that will shock the world to its core is what kind of summing up what he said. And it just seems to me that would be something that would, if they had like DNA evidence or somehow from the shroud and then be able to prove that this was Jesus somehow, and at the same time introduce aliens and so forth, and then, you know, it could be really, hurt the churches and so forth and really shake them up.
Yes, well, as I say, in the Middle Ages, it was really, all the new monasteries and abbeys had to have sacred relics, bones of Jesus, and that really attracted pilgrims. And you got more pilgrim trade, as I would call it, if you had more holy relics. And the Crown of Thorns was in the Saint Chapelle in Paris, for instance, and it was brought in by Saint Louis VII and all that. You had the Crown of Thorns, you had many holy lances, found on the First Crusade, and you had bits of the True Cross, and indeed bits of the bone of Jesus or bits of his skin. But these are all believed to be true, all brought back from Jerusalem. And I can't pronounce on the authenticity of any of them, but they were believed to be bits of Jesus.
What's the significance of all of this, Andrew, if we find out that the bloodline continued?
Well, I think it's what Mark said. I think if the bloodline continued, I don't believe that heredity is over 2,000 years. It wouldn't make anything different to somebody born 2,000 years later. What it matters is this force of intelligence or this life force or the secrets of attaining it, which is passed on from generation to generation to generation, as Mark suggests, and whether it's St. John the Baptist or Jesus or another. I don't know. I mean, the latest thing they claim to have discovered, interesting enough, is the tomb of Judas.
Yes.
And whether, you know, in the case of Judas, I think there's a new book by Jeffrey Archer coming out on the secret of Judas. But there's always an old sect, the Judas sect, the Cainites too, who believe that Judas was Saint Judas because he was forced to betray Christ. They've now found his tomb, they say. But I think what one looks for is revelation. And you may get it by these documents or life forces or energy. It's the quest for divine intelligence, not for actual bones of Jesus or bloodline of Jesus.
Okay, let's go to East of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Good morning.
Good morning, George. This is St. Elmo, and I'm calling from the, Reidsville, Georgia.
Yes, sir. Hi there.
And I get you out of Charlotte, North Carolina, believe it or not.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
I have two questions for Mr. St. Clair.
Okay.
All right. One, if what research I've done here, wasn't King James actually King Edward of Scotland?
Sorry, the King James?
Yeah, the one that translated the Bible. Wasn't he actually king, or called it to be
king? He was king of Scotland. He became, he was James the VI of Scotland.
Right, right.
And James the I, I, of England.
Right,
and he commissioned bishops, 15, who came up with, the, you know, the greatest work in English literature after Shakespeare, the King James's Bible.
Right, I understand. And the issue right there is, and that, that ratified and sanctified the Protestant element of the church in England. All right, the second inquiry I have of him, sir, is are you affiliated with Sinclair Oil, which later became BP?
Sorry, could you repeat that one?
Sinclair Oil, which became part of British Petroleum. Any right. relationship to you there?
Oh, yes. I tell you what, they went across to Georgia, you'll find the Sinclairs. And Sinclair Oil is certainly part of the clan. There was a big emigration, particularly in the Highland Clearances later on, of Sinclairs, chiefly to Canada. But you'll find Oglethorpe, and you'll find Sinclairs kicking the Spanish out of Georgia at one point. And later they go across Sinclair Oil and the Teapot Dome and all that. Yep.
All right, I understand. But the premise of my question was, in this, to give you some background here, I had occasion to speak with Senator Chambliss's office. He's our representative here in Georgia. I talked to Bridges, and I had an inquiry for him concerning an element in the recent report, the Baker-Hamilton report, which I think is page 57, had a recommendation that they give an ultimatum to the Iraqi people, well, actually the Iraqi government, that for the privatization of the oil. And I was just wondering, you know, what interest BP would have in that. And was that a stimulus for Britain coming to our aid? Because I cautioned him, I said, if this thing gets out, you know, if it's really this war was for oil as opposed to the freedom of the Iraqi people, this is going to be bad.
I don't know, St. Elmo, if he can answer that.
I see.
Andrew, if you want, it's up to you.
Well, I'll just make one comment. They went to the original Templars, went to Palestine then to look for holy oil. And I don't think it would be appropriate to have a last crusade against Iraq just for real oil.
Okay, let's go next to our first-time caller line. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, is that me?
Yeah, it sure is.
How are you?
Hi.
I wanted to ask Andrew if he knows anything about the Sinclairs in Nova Scotia in Canada. I used to live in Mahone Bay, and there was a lot of talk about some kind of a deep shaft that had been dug there by one of the Sinclairs. Have you ever heard of that, Andrew?
Oh, I've been to Nova Scotia looking for Prince Henry Sinclair, and I made a film about it even.
Did you really?
Which is on the History Channel over here. You can get it.
Really?
But I spent 2 weeks filming up and down. I found that cannon at Louisburg, the 14th century Venetian cannon. And that's pretty well proof that Prince Henry got there.
What about around Mahone Bay and Chester?
Yes, there is. I'm not quite of that school of thought. Other people earlier, man who did something on Prince Henry Sinclair, he said it was around Mahone Bay. And there were, I think, he built two settlements. One was at Louisburg, and later near Mahone Bay.
And what
he was
year?
Certainly there for a year.
Yeah. Have you any idea when that was?
1399.
I thought so.
To be
precise. Thank you. Thank you
very
much.
Not at all.
All right. Very good. Was there any talk of any of the work and research that you've both done about Noah's Ark at all?
Not for me.
How about you, Mark?
Noah's Ark. No, I can't say that I've gone into that particular territory.
Okay, so no hidden papers, nothing like that?
No.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Madeline.
Hi, Madeline. Go ahead.
I have a question for Mark. I had a dream one night about, I was actually giving my subconscious a command before I went to bed to show me any secrets that I knew of the Knights Templars. And I woke up maybe 2 hours later, and I had seen a wall that was covered with a bunch of symbols. And it had two center walls on the side of it. And then when I got his book, on page 14, there was a nice picture of it. And it says, a secret code of the Knights Templar. Does it contain the Holy Grail mysteries of the Far East? Do you know which picture I'm talking about?
Yes, actually, I'm looking at it myself right now.
Oh, cool. I was just curious where this is.
Where was this code from?
Yeah.
Well, apparently, it originated in the Middle East. As to its complete history, it's very difficult to say. It does appear to have had some secret society or mystery school influence. As Andrew mentioned, the Templars are very much involved with the Sufis and Gnostics, and actually they are very much involved with the Egyptian tradition as well. And so it seems to be a combination. It's of many different traditions. The Knights Templar were, they were great masters of codes. And
How did you come by it?
That particular picture, I believe, it was in the archives of my publisher, David Childress, who publishes my books and a series of others on esoteric subjects.
Do you know if anyone has translated any part of it?
I don't know that. I'm sorry. I don't know if anyone's working on that or if they have made any progress with that or not. You might try contacting David. He's the only one that I can think of at this point that could give you any further information on that. And he's with that Adventures Unlimited Press, and you can go to their website and get his information and contact him through that.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Okay.
I appreciate you being part of the program, too. Well, this half hour has whizzed by. We're going to have final phone calls when we come back on coasttocoastam.com with our two special guests tonight, Mark Pinkham, Andrew Sinclair, as we talk about Roslyn Chapel and the Knights Templar. Kind of a night of history today, ancient history. I'm even learning something. So we'll be back in a moment. If you need to email me Always simple. George at coasttocoastam.com. And when I come back, I'll tell you what's in store for tomorrow on Coast to Coast, as well as take your final questions. We'll be right back. Okay, we've got final phone calls now with our special guests, Mark Pinkham and Andrew Sinclair. Andrew, do you ever find your way to the States here?
Oh, I spent 8 of 20 years in America on the slippery slope from Harvard to Hollywood.
Back to the phones we go. We'll pick it up by going to our wild card line. Good morning. You're on the air with us.
Hey, George. How are you?
Fine. Thank you.
My name is Robin. I'm calling from Sacramento.
Okay.
Funny thing, earlier tonight I watched The Da Vinci Code for the first time, not knowing what your show was going to be about.
There you go.
And on the radio, and I was like, oh, my God. Anyway, I have a question for Andrew, please.
Okay, he's listening and ready.
Okay, are there any lists for genealogical purposes that would show which family names were connected to the Knights Templar?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's a thousand years of straight Roslin Sinclairs going back to the Vikings. And they went on crusades. And in Roslin Chapel, there is a Templar knight sculpted with an angel bearing a cross behind him and all the Templar symbols of the Lamb of God and their banners and everything. It is it's a post-Templar chapel.
That's fantastic, because I have I'm a history fanatic, and I do my family genealogies, and I have one line. Preliminary investigations has taken me back to Robert the Bruce, and on my mother's side of the family, my grandmother's name was Neville, and she can trace back. So I think she's a distant cousin to the 16th Earl of Warwick.
Well, I'll just tell you two things on that. The Bruces and the Sinclairs both came from Normandy. They were neighbors.
Yes.
And they intermarried, so you've also got Sinclair blood in you. As for the Nevilles and the Earl of Warwick and all, of course, the last time the Holy Rood was lost, actually, was at the Battle of Neville's Cross, which is a terrific encounter between the English and the rest. You certainly got a very good bloodline.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, I'm very proud of it. So, anyway, I'm enjoying the show tremendously, and I'm looking forward to your books.
Okay, thank you very much. Does it take you both long to research your books? You, Mark?
Well, it's getting shorter and shorter time these days because we have the Internet. Before the Internet, it took years and years. But of course, it also depends if there are certain bits of information that I have to travel, 10,000 miles to get to, and it might take me a while to get to that bit of research. But if I don't have to take these extended voyages across the sea, I could write a book easily in a matter of weeks now.
How about you, Andrew?
Well, it's taken me nearly 20 years to do the Roslin trilogy and now this big book on the Grail to come. But the point is, history is always an inquiry. You think you know something, but you always remain ignorant. There's always more to find out, and you have to travel to find it.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're up with us. Good morning.
Yes, this is Matthew from Apple Valley.
Hi, Matthew.
Andrew, I love your description of the quest to the Grail as a personal quest for higher enlightenment. I had a chance to go to Europe when I was young, stayed there about 10 years, met a man who said he was a Druid, I met a lot of the people he had been educated with. He was a Jesuit priest, very dissatisfied with the communists in the 60s in the Catholic Church. He claims, and you might verify this, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, I've never got a chance to verify it, but claims that the European nobility, primarily of Celtic origin, except the Anglo-Saxons of Britain were usurpers of that nobility. And he claims that, and I actually got a chance to meet Jean d'Orléans from Paris, the Dauphin of Paris. And they claim, sans royal, they claim direct lineage to Christ. Much of the European nobility does. Is there any verification of that?
Yes, well, I mean, this is really, it comes from the ancient Scottish Rite. It still goes on among the Masons. Mm-hmm. It was refounded in the 18th century. And you've got a lot of the nobility of Europe being brought in to become sort of latter-day Templars. And the idea, particularly somebody called the Duke of Albany, claimed the Sun Royal Merovingian descent,
yeah,
and therefore they did have part of the blood of Christ in them. It is a theory which goes around a lot, and a lot of people believe in it, and there we are. It's, I don't think it's provable, but it is a belief.
Uh-huh. They claim the movement of Protestantism is a Germanic movement, the Anglo-Saxon movement, the starkness and the hardness as being or supplanting the Celtic Catholicism.
That's totally true. And, you know, it's what I was talking about before. The Protestants destroyed all this beautiful late medieval monasteries, abbeys, and records. Mm-hmm. What's so interesting about the Masons and the Templars is that everything which they had in the early lodges and things with natures and temples was destroyed in the Reformation. It was because of the Jacobites, when they took on the Hanoverians, Bonnie, Prince Charlie, and the rest,
yeah,
to believe in the, to be a Catholic or to be a member of the ancient Scottish Rite and all that. That made you a traitor.
Mm-hmm.
And so they went across to France and they revived themselves in France. And that's where the ancient Scottish Rite went on, this belief. And it was through German aristocracy particularly. There were 12 princes and dukes who joined this ancient Scottish Rite. And the King of Sweden, oddly enough, Sweden and Germany, most aristocrats then claimed through the ancient Scottish Rite to be part of the Celtic nobility.
Wow, fantastic. Very interesting. Jesus was from Galway, or he was from the Galilee, is that correct?
From where?
Was Jesus from Galilee?
Well, yes, he was from Galilee.
Okay, Galilee, is it not, from its origin of the word, a Gaelic port or Gaelic area?
Well, it gets associated with Galway, actually.
Exactly. And
the stone of Scone, in which everyone, you know, it was crowned on, is meant to have been brought across. It from, actually, the Passion.
Well,
and the original kings of Ireland then took it to Scotland.
Okay, well,
it's now Christ, under the English thread.
Christ with his red hair, this Druid claims Christ was a Celt. Radically,
yes,
different from the Semitic culture and character.
That's the Irish legend. They had all the greatest monasteries in the Dark Ages were all Irish.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually believed in the Greek Rite, not in the Roman Rite.
Okay.
And they always claimed the stem of Jesse and of Jesus, who came from the stem of Jesse, that actually went through the stone of Scone, actually, went through to the Irish kings.
Wow.
Via all these monasteries.
Is that possibly true?
I don't know. I'm just telling you, this is very strong Irish legend.
Imagine
and it was the Greeks, I told you, Empress Helena,
uh-huh,
who discovered the tomb of Christ. So it's part of their belief.
Were the Greeks Celtic?
No, yes. Well, I mean, bit of history. Alexander the Great launched himself into the steppes. Who did he meet? The Celts.
Okay.
And he actually beat the Celts. They intermarried.
That's true. I do recall there were big battles between them.
That's right.
Okay. I'd love to speak with you sometime. Absolutely fascinating.
Well, we will speak.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate it. Next up, west of the Rockies, we've been waiting for you. Hi there.
Hi, this is John from Bonnie Lake, Washington.
Yeah, John, go ahead.
For Mark, I believe, I think he spoke and said that there are many sons of God. But, and this is true, I become a son of God by receiving the Holy Ghost, which to me is the Holy. I become the vessel, see. So you could say that's a form of a Holy Grail, too, because if we receive Christ, then his Holy Ghost comes and abides in us, and then he leads and guides us into all truth. But Jesus was the only begotten Son of God. So the Holy Ghost came upon Mary. No man did. And so Mary had Jesus, and the Father was God. And we're either of the spirit and nature of the Lord Jesus Christ, or we're Antichrist.
Well, anybody want to react to that?
Yeah, I'll comment on that.
Right.
What I've actually traced in my book, The Truth Behind the Christ Myth, is actually it was St. Paul that tacked on to the legend or history or life of Jesus this idea that he was born of a virgin, that he was born in December 25th, and that he's going to come back for one final battle, so forth and so on. This legend actually was, when St. Paul first learned it, it was the legend of Mithras, okay? St. Paul came from Tarsus in Cilicia, which was the headquarters of Mithras worship in Asia Minor. And what I show in my book is that Mithras was actually a Persian manifestation of a much earlier god or deity that came from the east, known as Sanat Kumara or Murugan. So the original legend of the Son of God born December 25th of a virgin, so forth and so on, actually starts, I found, in the Far East, and was Jesus actually born from a virgin? We don't really know, but we do know that that St. Paul grew up in an area that was highly charged with Mithras worship. He was a part of the temple guard. All the temple guards were Mithras worshiping. And it appears as though when St. Paul went down into the Holy Land and he heard about Jesus, he says, okay, I know that Jesus because he's our Mithras. Because the legend was in that tradition that Mithras was supposed to appear at that time. It was supposed to be the end of times. Another thing that you find out also is that the three magi came from Persia. This is what Marco Polo found out when he went across Persia. He actually visited the tombs of the three Persian magi. They were Persian priests. They were priests of Mithras. They also thought that Jesus was an incarnation of Mithras. And so do we know for sure about the life of Jesus? I would say definitely not. It does look as though there was a more ancient myth that was tacked on to his, however.
Okay, thanks. First time caller line, you're up with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi there. Where are you calling from, dear?
My name is Mary. I'm calling from Akron, Ohio.
Okay, Mary, go ahead.
George, I really want to tell you that I really like the show. You have a lot of very interesting subjects.
Well, thank you, Mary.
Yes. And I wanted to mention one thing first, that Jesus had beautiful auburn hair.
How do you know
and
that?
And I know because I've been with him.
Oh, you have? Oh,
yes, I have. But
tell
what
him
I
hi
really,
for me.
I'm sorry?
Tell him hi for me. I need an in.
Yeah. Anyway, what I wanted to ask either Mark or Andrew, they were discussing the bones of Jesus.
Yes.
In other words, they was talking about. Excuse my voice. It just. But anyway, they was discussing people talking about the bones of Christ. And I want to ask one of them, or both of them, how would they have bones from Christ when he was resurrected, according to my belief, my religion?
Oh, you mean rather if he was ascended, rather?
Ascended, yes.
Right,
he ascended into heaven.
Right,
why, you know, how would they get bones?
Well, that's the question. Was he ascended? Did he ascend?
Oh, I see. That. Okay.
Because there's also a legend that He went east. He went back to Kashmir, where he had been before earlier on in his travels. And if you go to Srinagar today, they'll take you to his tomb. And so the bones of Jesus supposedly is in that tomb. So it all depends on your belief.
I see. Yes, he was in a tomb, but on the third day, according to my belief, that he was resurrected from the tomb.
Right. Well, if he did truly ascend with his physical form, certainly then he would have taken his bones with him.
Bones with him, wouldn't he? Yes. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right, Mary. Thanks. Appreciate you being part of the program. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're up with us. Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
I was curious as to whether there'd be any reputable firms that do genealogy in Canada and the U.S. I mean, you go to genealogy.com and you look for your name, and suddenly you come up with a whole pile of different people in your background that there's a good possibility that none of them are really related to you. And I was curious as to whether Andrew knows anybody that actually does a responsible job.
I'm not sure. Do you, Andrew?
Well, to this degree, they've done an enormous amount of this later. People, I think there's a channel here called Heredity.com or something like it. But as I was saying, there's this museum in Gala Shields. They cover about all the border clans. And I don't know your surname. And there are various organizations, particularly over here, which, depending on your surname, would cover it wholly.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Okay.
What is your surname?
Nickerson.
Nicholson? Go to Gallery Shields. Nicholson's come from there. They're part of the border clans.
Really?
Yep.
That's amazing. Okay.
So it's all sitting there. It's called the Border Hereditary Museum. It's in Gallery Shields on the border. I'll tell you all about the Nicholsons there.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being part of the program. Well, the clock's quickly coming to an end here. And, Andrew, why don't you wrap things up for us with a little summation?
What I've tried to say, and I think most of the questions have tried to say, is that the Grail, and Ross Lynn is a chapel of the Grail, it's really a question of you personally going out there, and I think people were saying it, even the man about the sons of God. Really, it's the quest for the divine intelligence. And you get it by a revelation, really, of some sort or not. But at the end of the day, it's nothing much to do with church or state. It's you looking for your spirit. And that is the quest for the Grail.
Okay, very good. And Mark, how about you?
I would say in summation that, to my mind, as I mentioned earlier, that the true Grail is the power that once it enters within you, it does the work of opening up to your own inner wisdom. And I believe that the secrets of that process, the secret of the whole Gnostic tradition that has existed for thousands of years, is embedded in Roslyn Chapel as documents, but also with covering all the walls. The Sinclairs were Gnostics themselves. They preserved the Gnostic tradition of the Cathars, of the Templars. It's all there right in Roslyn Chapel. Even the chapel itself is an alchemical crucible. It's generating the power of that energy that will open you up to your own gnosis. And
Mark and Andrew, thank you so much for being part of Coast to Coast. For Steve Cardin, Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.